Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
Good morning, Dr. Paul.
Good. You know, this station and the Ron Paul Institute, which you head up, have been very interested in foreign policy, obviously. So, and we've been anxiously looking at and analyzing the coming foreign policy. What kind of foreign policy will Trump give us? And we get some hints. We heard some hints in the campaign, and we pointed out that sometimes it was flip-flopping, and we don't know exactly what it is, and we have written about that. So we were watching very closely on what would happen on the first day. And there was some dramatic things happening on the first day. And this may be an indication on which direction they're going to go in. And, of course, on the first day, it was known that there were 31 strikes in Syria and Iraq. You know, the bombs are dropping in continuation. Sounded to me like it got a little kick up. And I would think that Trump, would, even though he was newly in charge, he's still responsible for that. And so what we would like to do today is talk about that and the foreign policy and whether this is a sign of things to come. And, of course, in order to do that, we have to sort of look at where we're coming from, and that's the Obama foreign policy. And I always wanted to, you know, compliment Obama and praise him and when I could. And I did it on a few occasions. I thought it was correct because I liked opening up the door with Iran, and I liked opening up the conversation with Cuba. These things are good. But then again, if you want to list the things where Obama was not exactly fulfilling his role as the Nobel Peace Prize winner, it's a different story. So let's start off by talking a little bit about this first day. What all happened on the first day? Was this a surprise to you at all that there were that many bombs dropped on day one?
Well, you know, there was some speculation as to whether these things were already in the pipeline, you know, and it was something that that he didn't necessarily want to stop. They were already going. And there's simply, you know, that could be one of the factors. But, you know, the greatest fallacy that the neocons perpetuate is the idea that Barack Obama was a feckless peace president, you know, who did nothing. He dropped 26,000 bombs in 2016. He was involved in bombing seven Muslim countries. A president who was at war every single day he was in office. But the neocons will say he didn't do enough of what he was doing, but what he was doing obviously did not produce results. And so now it looks like the Trump administration will continue with the mistakes of the previous administration.
It didn't produce the results that the neocons wanted, but I don't think it produced conditions that Obama wanted. He wanted a smart war. He wanted to not see a lot of Americans die, but he wanted to keep doing what we have been doing, and that is a weak neocon policy of being involved. And look at the tragedies he caused in Libya. Look at the mess that he really aggravated in Syria by declaring Assad has to go, and on and on. And then, of course, the good war for him was always Afghanistan. That's the longest war ever, and Iraq is a mess. So he really created conditions, although you can say, well, yeah, but there were more Americans dying when we had a lot of troops on the ground and this sort of thing. But he was arguing that this is a smart way to go, a smart war. But really, is it? Even under today's conditions, the way I see it, things are worse because there's been more aggravation than ever. How can you drop 26,000 bombs and not kill a few innocent people? Matter of fact, kill a lot of innocent people, and we have this collateral damage. Our moral standards is we only kill bad people, suspects, you know, maybe suspect. So, but how many people now hate America more than they did, 8 years ago? I certainly don't think there's less. But we were already very much involved in this. Obama didn't invent this type of policy that aggravates the people in the Middle East. And the blowback phenomenon has been around a long time. And that's my argument, that as long as this policy continues, we're going to continue to have a lot of blowback. And we're vulnerable. And it's not the way we defend our national security.
And we continue to have a misdiagnosis of the cause of ISIS, the origin of ISIS. The neocons say ISIS arose because President Obama took our troops out of Iraq. It's because we didn't occupy them long enough and hard enough. Well, the fact of the matter is, it's absolutely clarified in fact that ISIS emerged after the U.S. destabilized the Iraqi society, disbanded the Iraqi army, and left a lot of them with nothing to do but stew in their juices, many of them being in prison. This is the origins of ISIS. It's not our getting out, but it's our intervention in the first place. So how can more of the intervention that created ISIS somehow defeat ISIS? It's illogical.
And the hints that we get from the president is that ISIS will not be ignored. It has to go anywhere, any place quickly and destroy and eliminate ISIS. And I have a problem with that, with something we wrote about, you know, in the TST this week, our weekly report. And that is that that ISIS is, of course, generated by our policy, and we continue to have these problems if we continue to do the same thing. And that's where I really get the hang up, is that he is attacking an idea. Yeah. ISIS is radical, and they want to kill people, and their incentive, of course, I think, is occupation. And that's why we have it. So it's an ideological reaction to our ideas that we should be over there changing the Middle East, remaking the Middle East, forcing them to have elections. And that's a reflection, you know, of that. And I compare it to the way communism was defeated. Communism was a menace, and I frequently mention I happen to have been drafted, you know, during the Cuban crisis, you know, because of the really hot Cold War that went on. But we never used the nuclear weapons. We never had to invade Russia, but it was an ideology that was doomed to fail. And so, therefore, when an idea has times have come, or one that has failed, it's a overpowering. Armies don't make a difference. And that's the way this is. The armies cannot destroy the ideology of what the radicals believe in. And the other thing that I think I find annoying is that they conflate all Muslims, all Islam, with this radical movement. To me, that's sort of like taking a few people who, you know, look at the Old Testament and how some evangelicals will look at the need for Christianity to do certain things, that we have this moral obligation to remake the Middle East. I mean, that can be, you know, just as detrimental. So I think it's this idea that we can destroy this ideology just by more weapons. And when he says, I'm going any place, every place, quickly, and eradicate all radicals. And I think it's impossible that you have to defeat a bad idea with a better idea.
Yeah, eliminating radical Islamic terrorism is what he says is his goal. But it's not possible, as you point out. It's not possible to do that with force of arms, just as it would not be possible to defeat communism with force of arms alone. If the U.S. had arrested every single communist in the U.S. in the 1970s, for example, that would have just pushed communism further. They would have said, look, Marx was right. Capitalism, in its very end stages, starts to devour itself. So you can't defeat it that way. As a matter of fact, ISIS is already on the ropes in eastern Syria. It's on the ropes because the Syrian Arab Army and their allies, the Russians and the Iranians, have taken it on very effectively and have defused it. As a matter of fact, the U.S. is making things worse. Remember the bombing in Deir ez-Zor, where the U.S. killed, I think it was 100 Syrian army officers who were holding that eastern part for the government and keeping the radical Islamists away. The U.S. bombed these people and ISIS took over. So whether it was on purpose or inadvertently, our presence there is actually making things a lot worse and forestalling the inevitable fall of ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
You know, I think Trump has justifiably, he's explained his position by going after Islam, radical Islam. And that would open up the door to doing probably anything he wants in the Middle East. But his foreign policy is starting to leak out, and we hear vibes about other parts of the world. That same argument of aggression, that we are going to wipe out ISIS, wouldn't apply to the South China Sea. Is it going to apply to Venezuela? It may apply, I'm sure they would say it applies to Iran, you know. But once again, it's the inconsistency. Iran has to be handled and taken care of, and our open door policy has to be canceled. But here, we're closing a door with China. You know, we're just looking for it. And then when he talks about Taiwan, I mean, this just, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it doesn't all fit into that neat little category, you know, of going after the radicals, because he's talking about a much broader scope. They happen to have tremendous sympathy. I think it was Tillerson that indicated that he had a fair amount of sympathy for Saudi Arabia, and also I think Venezuela as well. I mean, but they're talking about regime change in Venezuela. That's not attacking ISIS.
And that goes directly against what President Trump said in his inaugural address. We're not going to seek to remake countries. But, you know, Spicer, the White House spokesman, held his first sort of normal press conference yesterday where he actually took questions and discussed things. And it was assumed that he might correct some of the things that Tillerson said at the confirmation hearings, where he was really doing a lot of saber rattling when it came to China. We will deny China the ability to access these islands. And people were speculating that he may have misspoken, that Spicer would come and correct it. But Spicer, if anything, was even more hawkish in some of the things that he said yesterday. And I think even the neocons, who love getting us right up to war, but they don't actually want one, I think even the neocons are a little bit worried about this.
You know, he makes a real good statement about, on international waters, they have to be protected, and nobody should just go in there and make this declaration of international waters, which is questionable even legally whether or not they could do that. But he says, if they're doing that, we're going to take care of it. You know, all the rules apply to everybody else. Nobody else should do it. But by golly, if they're doing it, we're going to be in charge. What are they going to do with it? Just blow up the islands, or are they going to take them over? And they say, well, we don't want to have a war over this. But what if China wants to have a war over it? You know, it's just so unnecessary to go through this thing. You know, I think one of the most amazing time for me was the awakening on how fragile the world is and doesn't need to be. And that was back, I guess it was 2011, dealing with Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine was rocky and messed up, but they did have somebody that won an election, Yanukovych.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, the whole thing blows up. And then, you know, sanctions were put on, and it's just been escalating. And I don't see any reason whatsoever that they had to backtrack on friendship. Now, this is one area that I can't complain about Trump. He sort of is in that camp. Why do it? And he did, I think, make a statement, oh, we have no plans to do what our government's been doing, and that is to unseat Assad. I think we've already declared failure there. Assad has to go, but before Obama left office, I guess we're going to let Assad stay.
Well, we would hope that that Trump understands that it was our interventionist policy that created the mess in Ukraine. There was a dispute between Ukraine and Russia beforehand. It was about the direction of the country because it's divided. The same is true in the South China Seas. There is a dispute among the countries in the region. Actually, I like this quote from the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman. The United States is not a party to the South China Sea dispute. All you have to do is look at a map and notice that. But there have been, for example, in the last few weeks, a couple of months, the Philippines have sort of reached kind of a rapprochement with China. Now, they did lodge a small complaint with the Chinese putting some weapons on some of these islands, but it's been handled bilaterally between the two of them. It's when the U.S. comes in as a big bully and tries to push Vietnam and push Taiwan and push the Philippines against China. That's where you have the tension. The same was true in Ukraine.
You know, I think Ukraine is a good lesson for us and a good example on how a libertarian might allow this to be settled. And that is the right of self-determination, and let countries pick and choose on which way they want to go, even separate each, you know, have a division if they would like, and for the superpowers to stay out. But I would argue that the superpowers can take care of their neighbors. You know, they're justified more on dealing with their neighbors than somebody 6,000 miles away. So we are more justified in dealing with what's happening in Mexico, you know, in Canada. But Ukraine was a mess. There was half the east was leans toward. Right, they even spoke Russian yeah. Language. And then the east was closer to Europe, and that was the argument over which way they should go. But you know, if the people were left alone, they might have had a de facto separation, and maybe they could even have a legal separation and have east and west, and let the west go with the Europeans, and have some agreements there with trade, and the west. And then the East could identify, you know, with Russia. But it would have to be internal, have to be voluntary. People would have the right of self-determination. And we would have to have a little less aggressiveness by the superpowers who think that they have empires. You know, whether it was a Soviet empire or whether it's our empire that we have now, the attitude of empire is disastrous. It just leads to trouble, but it always leads to failure. It leads to bankruptcy. It leads to blowback. And I don't think anybody realizes that we are very vulnerable. And Trump would probably agree with that. That's why he wants to double the size, or, you know, quadruple, or make the, you know, the military much, much bigger, which is going against what I'm saying, that we don't need more militarism. What we need is more open doors, you know, where we can trade with people, and we don't need to look for a fight with Iran. We don't need to quit the direction we're going with Cuba. We don't need to look for a fight with China, and we should continue to try to keep the door open with Russia. But the thing that has bothered me is, why does it just pops up right out of the air? It seems to be going pretty well, then all of a sudden something changes and the whole thing breaks down. So any effort made from 1990 up to a few years ago was sort of, it's almost been canceled already, you know, and the antagonisms continue to build.
The other thing we failed to mention, and we can't really go into it, but he also ordered, or at least allowed, 2 drone strikes on Yemen. And that was really Obama's signature move, much more than Bush, was using drones. So if that's an indication that the U.S. is going to continue its involvement in the war in Yemen on the side of Saudi Arabia, and using drones, which kill a lot of civilians, that's also a bad sign.
Well, we're going to finish here soon, but I want to mention a little bit about, you know, what Obama's leaving us. And there were some change in policy, such as not only the drone wars going on, which was started by Bush, but things like assassinations and torture and different things like
kill
that
list,
and kill this. I don't think that's going to change. I think because Trump has said some pretty strong things in the campaign about torture. But we also know that Congress has nothing to do with these wars, essentially nothing. They roll over and send all the money they want, whatever you want to do, go and do it. But the CIA is very much involved in policy, as well as these special forces. They're a unit to themselves. Yeah. And now we have a new director of the CIA. I don't think he's going to resist in any way a really, really tough foreign policy. I think he would agree 100%. We are going to do anything and everything wherever we're going to go. We are going to utterly eradicate every radical in the world. And that, I think, is going to lead to trouble.
And, you know, we find ourselves optimistic at some of the things that Trump himself says, but not wanting to overturn governments and these sorts of things. But every single person that he's hired to serve him in the national security area doesn't seem to hold those views. So if he is indeed honest about this position, how is he going to keep these people in line?
Yeah, I don't like the militarization of what's going on. Anyway, I would like to thank our viewers today for tuning in. We obviously feel very strongly about foreign policy for the United States and the direction. I don't think we have the answer and know exactly which way it's going. I'm not even sure the administration does, because there are some good vibes coming from the administration, and we will point that out and encourage it. But there's also some risk in what we're doing and the policies that we're here about, because we're a long way from bringing the troops home and minding our own business. And that, of course, I think is the way we can achieve peace and prosperity. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.